Welcome to Garden DC, the podcast about everything gardening in the Washington, D.C. and Mid-Atlantic region. I'm your host, Kathy Gents. I'm the editor of Washington Gardener magazine, and we're aimed at gardening enthusiasts, people who grow everything from edibles to ornamentals, natives to exotics. If it grows in our area, that's what we talk about. Welcome to episode 171 of the Garden DC podcast. In this episode, we chat with Marta McDowell, author of Gardening Can Be Murder and DuPont Gardens of the Brandywine Valley. The plant profile is on blue mist shrub, and we share what's going on in the garden as well as some upcoming local gardening events in the What's New segment. We close out with the last word on Fun with Pumpkins by Christy Page at the Food Gardening Network. This episode, we're joined by Marta McDowell, garden writer and speaker, and she's going to be talking to us all about her new books, and I say books plural. Welcome, Marta.
Thanks, Kathy.
So you have been a busy, busy, busy garden writer, and you have two books out, one on the DuPont Gardens and one on Gardening Can Be Murder, or Mystery Writers and the Use of the Garden. But before we dive into all of that, we like to ask our guests on the Garden DC podcast, were they born with chlorophyll in their vein and a green thumb?
No, I think in my case, the gardener was made, not born, unless it skipped a generation, Kathy, because my parents, I think, did a lot of weeding when they were children. My father grew up on a farm. My mother's father had a huge vegetable garden out in the country. And I think they just pulled too many weeds. So they, you know, they kept the yard tidy, and that was about it. But I started gardening when I first had a little bit of earth of my own. So I was in my 20s, and I basically memorized the White Flower Farm catalog at the time, which was in the 90s, and bought a lot of plants, killed a lot of plants, and, you know, just learned to love plants. And I've been gardening ever since.
Mm-hmm. I think White Flower Farm was my first garden catalog, too, now that you mention it, Marta.
It had a ton of horticultural information, how to pronounce the botanical names, beautiful pictures back in the day when you couldn't point your smartphone at a plant and press the information button.
Mm-hmm. I think twinning with that was Wayside Gardens for me.
Okay, yes, absolutely. That was another one of my frequently dipped into. I guess it was the Daffodil Mart at the time, you know. Now, Brett and Becky's Bulbs, you know, those were really my go-to places. And, you know, I still have plants from all of those places, even though I have moved several times, the plants have moved with me.
Wonderful. And so was your career ambition in the writing field?
I worked in the corporate world for 20 years. I always wrote, regardless of, you know, I was working in insurance and systems, but I always had writing and sort of teaching related jobs. And before I left that job, they funded my midlife crisis by giving me a separation package. I had started working on this idea of becoming something in full-time horticulture, be it writing, teaching, actually gardening, design. And I've done like all of them. So it's always kind of hard for me to pick a title because I still have my fingers in a lot of things, but they're all related to growing things.
Mm-hmm. I would say similar, wearing many hats. And so let's talk a little bit about your garden and where you garden, like your zone, your soil.
Yes, I am a zone 6 garden, quickly inching towards 6B. I am in Chatham, New Jersey. Chatham is in the north, kind of east part of New Jersey. You know, we're about, I don't know, 30 miles from Manhattan. It's in a, you know, the kind of the Piedmont area. So it's rolling, it's kind of ridges, you know, ridge and valley, edge of the old Wisconsin glacier. So every time you stick a soil in my, you know, in my back 40, you goes thunk. I have about, I don't know, probably between a third and a half an acre, a long skinny plot. So tons of shade in the front, total deer country, fenced in back with sunny patches and a lot of shade. So half of it is just woods, zero lawn. Actually, the front is also zero lawn. My lawn is like the size of a postage stamp. So it's really, it's my, also my incredible shrinking lawn, which my spouse reminds me, like every year my lawn gets a little smaller and soon it will be nothing, but that's okay. Or my so-called lawn, because, you know, my philosophy is, well, if it's green and you mow it, that's my lawn, because I don't put any chemicals on the lawn.
Excellent. Yeah, and I think a lot of our listeners can relate to that, and that many of them are mid-Atlantic growers and gardeners, and that they can relate to shoving that spade or shovel in the ground and then having it reverberate on them. And do you have any clay soil, or are you alkaline? How are you?
No, it's clay. The pH is, you know, is good for most mm-hmm. things, you know, because so it's sort of, you know, that sweet spot for growing plants. You know, the soil retains water, unlike my sister in South Carolina, where it had to be the bottom of an ocean where she is, because it's all sand. Well, you get that on the edge of glaciers too. But anyway, her soil is entirely different from mine, which was a real shocker when I went down there to help her with her plantings. And what else can I tell you about my little spot? I told you lots of shade, mostly flowers and ornamentals. I have a big community garden plot. Again, lots of cut flowers down there, but also, you know, the usual tomatoes, beans, etc. And I have some little raised boxes near the house that I also grow vegetables. I grow a lot of herbs because you can grow them where the deer are. Mm-hmm. I grow a little bit of everything. I have way too many plants. But what is enough when it comes to plants?
Exactly. Definitely, I think many of us can relate to that. So let's turn to your writing career and the books you have authored. So a lot of the books you've written have been about other authors and their gardens. So one on Beatrice Potter. And can you tell me a little bit about how you gravitated to those topics?
Sure. So entirely accidental, except for the fact that, you know, gardening and reading are kind of neck and neck for the things I really, really love to do. And I was an American Studies major in college, which was the best major ever, because, you know, basically you could take anything if it had the word American in the title, except maybe not. I don't know about forgetting a job. For that, I took some computer science. But I had so much fun. It's a ton of writing and a ton of reading. But they're all things I'm interested in. So, you know, here I am in this corporate career. I'm on a business trip visiting insurance agencies in Massachusetts. So, you know, you can imagine that. And I had a spare afternoon with nothing scheduled. So I picked up a brochure in a rest area and saw Emily Dickinson Homestead, is what it was called at the time. And so I drove to Amherst. I got on the last tour of the day. Actually, it was only me. So I had, you know, an individual tour. And I found out that she, in addition to being a poet, was a gardener. And it opened a door that I have never shut, right? So here I am, you know, working 60-hour weeks and starting to research Emily Dickinson and her gardening interests. So that kind of really changed, I would say Emily Dickinson changed my life because it gave me a way to think about these two things that I really loved, gardening and reading, in a different way. And, you know, from then on, I was always sort of on the lookout, right? If any of your listeners have any ideas, send them along. I'm always looking for writers who garden. And so from then on, most of my subjects, you know, kind of bumped into me in different ways. And I've pretty much stayed on that track, with the exception of All the President's Gardens, which came about in an in a different way. I don't know, different story, but that's how it happened. And so it was really serendipity, and aren't so many things in life serendipity.
Mm-hmm. But it's great that you were able to combine those two passions of reading and gardening and, you know, research together.
Yeah, it's been so much fun. And it's still fun. And so, you know, how wonderful is it when you can work at something that really, you know, charges you up? It's not that it's not work, because it is work. Trust me, it is work. But it's work that I want to come back to all the time.
Mm-hmm. You're not questioning, why am I doing this all the time?
Yes, which I did when I was, you know, giving the latest corporate philosophy to insurance agents out in the field who frankly didn't care.
Oh, so let's turn to your two new books, and we'll do them in order. And first is DuPont Gardens of the Brandywine Valley. And I must say, it is the quintessential coffee table book, because it is not something that is easily read in bed, as I tried to do over the last week.
Right. It is got a lot of weight because it's primarily a book of photography. So Larry Letterman is a photographer, a very interesting person. He was a mergers and acquisitions attorney for his career. He took up photography in retirement and has spent a lot of time and, you know, a lot of his artistic effort at the New York Botanical Garden, where he's published several books. But the one that is, you know, kind of the most prominent for me is Trees of the New York Botanical. So he loves to photograph trees. That's kind of his origin story for how he became a photographer. And so he and his editor at Monticelli contacted me and said, would I be interested in writing the essays to accompany this book that is about five of the DuPont family gardens in the Brandywine Valley.
And it is such a beautiful book. His photographs are amazing. And having visited all five of those many times, I can say he really captures the feel of all of them.
So you were at an advantage to me when I was starting out, because I had visited three of them. So, you know, when the editor said, you know, it is these gardens, I was quite familiar with Longwood and Mount Cuba and Winterthur, but the other two, Hagley and Nemours, were blank spots on the canvas that had to be filled in. So that was very interesting. The other interesting part was these are, for the most part, these are absolutely mammoth gardens. They're huge, as you might expect from gardens of the DuPonts. So they had money, they liked to have country houses, and they liked to have their country houses surrounded with acreage for a variety of reasons, including they were also interested in agriculture in addition to horticulture. And so to get one of those gardens into 2,000 words, you know, in one way, you could barely list their, you know, these are their elements. So I had to, that was the biggest puzzle with that book, was how to say something significant about the gardens and their history in such a small number of words.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and some of them, you know, especially the Hagley, which is pretty much the origin garden for them, that is a lot of history to pack in there.
Yes, because the DuPonts arrived at what is now called Hagley, but then they called it Eleutherian Mills in 1802. So this, you know, that's a lot of years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm glad you, so you say Eleutherian Mills. I've always said Eleutherian. I never knew how to pronounce it.
Well, don't, you know, I think that's the way to say it. And I was doing my best to imitate the way they say it in, you know, in the library at Hagley. So excuse my French pronunciation if you have any listeners who are fluent in French, but that's mm-hmm. the best I can do.
And so for this book, I guess I'll give you the stumper question of the five, do you have a favorite?
You know, that's very hard because they are quite different. And that was deliberate on the part of the DuPont garden maker generation. Mm-hmm. They wanted each of their properties to have some unique characteristic within the context of, you know, they are all in this kind of rolling landscape and all in, you know, like a 10-mile radius. I mean, so they are, it's quite a compact area, which makes it great if you're visiting these gardens, because you could take a weekend, preferably a long weekend, where you feel very energetic and do all five. So do I have a favorite? You know, that's all, you know, people always ask me that with my books too. In a way, I guess, I don't know. Every time I think, oh yes, it's that one, I go, no, but what about that one? So I'm going to say no, I don't really have a favorite. Mount Cuba is very close to my heart because I saw it before it was open to the public. Mm. So it was still actually a family garden. I'm so enamored of the work they do there in terms of research on, you know, native plants and plant testing for varieties that will grow for the home gardener. And also their displays are absolutely breathtaking. So mm-hmm. I think the first time I was there in the spring and saw their kind of West Slope forest walks underplanted with all of these spring ephemerals that are native to the Piedmont, I just, you know, it's like I wanted to burst into tears. It was so gorgeous. Mm-hmm. But that's also true, you know, of each of the gardens. You know, Winterthur, if you're there and you see the March Bank, or you're there and you see the azaleas, or you go to Longwood and it's, you know, it's the weather's not good that day and you walk through the conservatories and you're just, you know, stunned. I fell in love with Hagley the first time I visited. The head gardener took me through Louise Crown and Shield's sort of Italianate ruin, because it really is a ruin now. It hasn't been maintained, and I hope they can stabilize it. It is the most haunting garden space I've seen on this side of the Atlantic. And Nemours has just this regal kind of serenity, you know, in different lights and different times of day. So they're all really special.
Yeah, I would say that would be a tough choice between them, very much so. But I think Mount Cuba, the one you started with, because of its intimacy and its more human scale, that might be my personal favorite of the five.
Yeah, it was interesting to me because all of these gardens weren't really used as family gardens. You know, children played there, they played in the pools, they had family parties. And while they're, you know, for mere mortals, like most of us, who couldn't even fathom having that much resource to expend on our gardens, they do have a quality of, you know, these were places that were loved. And while they had a lot of staff, the owners were extremely involved, you know, mm-hmm. that varied, you know, by the individual, but they were very engaged with these gardens. This wasn't like, oh, you know, I'm going to have somebody come in and do my garden and I'm going to just appear once in a while and enjoy it. They were really all involved in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, hear, hear. And if you haven't visited all five, this book will definitely give you motivation to do so and inspiration and maybe even some longing over the winter months to get out there.
The wonderful thing for me was, you know, I went to each garden. I went around with their experts, sometimes in gardening and sometimes in the history of the garden and sometimes both. And then I did a lot of research. But of course, when I sat down to write, unlike Larry, who was photographing them, you know, I could do it from my desk in New Jersey. I didn't have to physically be there. Mm-hmm. And as I was writing, he was sending me the images that were selected, you know, that he was going to be submitting for the book. And then, you know, went through a selection process. But I got to then see these gardens again through his eyes. And he has a really amazing ability to capture kind of the almost the intent of the garden composition. That sometimes, you know, when I was walking through it, and you know, I'd see, you know, acres and acres of gardens and so many different parts of these gardens in one or two days, that I got to experience them again through his eyes. And so, you know, his images are just exquisite. And I think that even if you've been to these gardens, you know, through your whole lives, you will see them in a new way through Larry's photographs.
Mm-hmm. So a great holiday gift idea, especially for the other gardeners in your life. So we're going to do a 180, Marta, and talk about your other new book, and I'm going to read the entire title because I think it is so funny. Gardening Can Be Murder, subtitled How Poisonous Poppies, Sinister Shovels, and Grim Gardens Have Inspired Mystery Writers.
I'm glad you like it. And I will say, you know, this is the sixth book that I've done with Timber Press, and it's the first time they've used my title.
Good to know.
Although the editor, I have to give the editor credit. He did the subtitle. Mm-hmm. He asked me, you know, is this all right? Can I do this? And, you know, we talked about a few of the words, but he came up with the, you know, the extra hook. So.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking about the book, and it goes through, starts off with the history of mystery writing, which starts off with Edgar Allan Poe, a favorite of mine, and then goes into the French novel, which the name just flew out of my head, and then back to the British and American versions of Gothic novels and on to our modern mystery novels. And how many of them have used gardening as a setting, gardening as part of maybe the murder itself, and or a clue to the murder, but we'll parse those apart in a second. But first, I wanted to dive into the similarities of gardening and being a detective. So I think that's part of the reason why mystery writers might be using gardening so much in their stories. So what can we say about how gardeners and detectives are similar?
You know, what garden isn't a mystery? Let's mm-hmm. face it, you know, one year a plant will do beautifully And the next year, same plant, same spot. And for some reason, it doesn't. It doesn't thrive. I find this, you know, particularly with annuals, where I'll put an annual in a spot, you know, and it goes gangbusters. The next year, not so much. And I think I have done the same thing in terms of, you know, feeding it, watering it. It's got the same exposure, nothing. You know. And then you go, why? Why is that? And, you know, or why is this hole in this leaf, you know, tracking down what is the pest or disease or, you know, whatever that is affecting this plant. Mm-hmm. So I think that's part of it, you know, that it just always is a puzzle and isn't that fun on most days.
Mm-hmm. And I would say it's almost literal because you're trying to figure out a lot why something died. Like literally you're trying to find out that mystery. And then of course there's also the coincidence that maybe we both use a loop or a magnifying glass as the classic Sherlock Holmes does.
Well, that's very true. Good point. I like that. And, you know, sometimes those pests do leave fingerprints. Mm-hmm. They leave a trail for us to track down. And, you know, who among us has not had that sort of homicidal instinct when they see that friendly groundhog has moved from the clover in the so-called lawn to the tulips.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that's, you know, the commonality of gardeners and the murderers in mystery books is almost more aligned because, yeah, there's so many things I was looking at in gardening that equates us to killers.
Sad but true.
Sad but true. So I was looking at, obviously, weeding, you know, just the act of weeding, selecting one plant over another is an act of plant murder in that case.
Yes, it is. You know, we have this sort of control thing of we are going to intervene in one way or another.
Mm-hmm. And then I was making a little short list of ways of violence in the garden. So deadheading, you know, that's, you know, right there on the nose. Thinning seedlings. So, you know, such a nice little way of saying, I'm going to kill all the little babies that I don't need.
Well, it's, you know, Kathy, I will tell you a story. A friend of mine, her spouse could not bring himself to kill baby spider plants, which meant, of course, their house was jammed with spider plants to the point where, you know, I don't, you know, eventually they were going to have to move out because it was going to be like that old Star Trek episode of The Trouble with Tribbles. You know, it was just going to be like, they were going to have to vacate the space and let the spider plants take over. So yes, you know, that is a part of it. You know, even though now, you know, in my circle, there are, you know, Facebook plant swap groups where you can say, I just dug this out of my garden and it's in a bucket on my driveway. If you want, you know, to try not to kill them, you know, or you can tell yourself, well, you know, they're going into the compost pile. So I'm not actually killing them. I am like recycling them into the soil.
Yeah, that's definitely how I make myself feel better.
Yes. And so I wonder if murderers get started that way.
Oh, I'm just adding to the compost pile. Yes. And then I was jotting down overly aggressive pruning and cleaning out a bed. And I think those are ways for people to get out their aggression sometimes and almost therapy where it doesn't have to be an actual homicide, say, if you get in a fight with a partner or spouse.
Yes. And, you know, I have a tool that is literally, the product name is Root Slayer. You want to get out some aggressions? Get out this thing. It's sharp. It's jagged. It's heavy. You can really whack at some sapling or some shrub that has suckers.
Yeah, I would say you touch on the tools in the book, and so many of the tools in the garden can be damaging, if not deadly, and not only to the victim, but to the garden themselves. I'm always like shocked about the things that they allow gardeners to have sometimes.
Yes, and I will tell you, if you try to go through TSA security with your secateurs, with your pruning shears, you will be nabbed. Because I was going, you know, so I think I was going down to my sister's to help her prune. And I didn't even think about it because I don't think of it as a weapon any more than I think of my knitting needles as a weapon. But there you go.
Exactly. I would say all garden implements need to be in the checked luggage.
Yes, definitely.
So let's start off with some of the mysteries that you describe in the book. So you don't give spoilers, which is great for those who haven't read them or not familiar with them. But why do you think so many mystery writers are drawn to a garden setting or a garden theme in their books?
Well, for some of them, they are gardeners. So that old saw about, you know, write about what you know, you know, comes naturally to them. Others look for different, you know, skills and elements and traits that they can give to their characters. And, you know, so you need various plot devices, and then, you know, gardening will come up. I think that's why there are so many British garden mysteries that, you know, I gardened in England for 6 months, and, you know, visitors walking through these gardens would be discussing these plants with the proper botanical nomenclature, which is not something that you often hear in public gardens in the U.S. So there's a different level of garden literacy there. So I think that's why there are so many British garden-themed books of detective and crime fiction. You know, and then it's fun, right? It's fun to write about gardens. So that's part of it too.
Yeah, and I think there's that affinity between growing and the life cycle in the garden that, you know, could be used for parallels. And, you know, you talk a little bit in the book about red herrings and using clues in the garden throughout a book, but it might not be the main theme of the mystery.
Right, right. And I mean, even for me in developing this book, so I think the list of novels and short stories that I put together for the end of the book, and it is on my website too, is 100 books that I use to create this survey. Sometimes I encountered my own red herrings. So, you know, I thought, oh, no orchids for Miss Blandish. That'll be perfect. I can use that. And that will let me have a little bit of, you know, sort of hard-boiled crime fiction included. But the funny thing was, there are no orchids in the book. No orchids for Miss Blandish other than on the title page and the cover. So, oops. Same with Black Dahlia. You know, it's like, okay, well, this is like, geez. So that was a red herring. There's one I'm reading now called Down the Garden Path, which is kind of a vintage mystery, a British mystery. But again, other than there are characters named Primrose and Hyacinth, I don't think that there is really a garden in this book. So I'll we'll see if that gets added to my online list or not.
I don't want to call it false advertising, but Yeah, and then there's always the occasional person named Garden or Mr. Gardener, which has nothing to do with gardening.
Yes.
I think my favorite section of your book is the chapter on clues in the garden and how mystery writers use, you know, either a plant part or something that they can say this grows only in South America in this one little country, so it has to be so-and-so. You know, that's almost like modern detective work. I think about the Smithsonian Labs being sent in a sample of mud from somebody's shoe and it identifying them to a specific place. But what I really loved about the clue chapter is the acknowledgement of plant blindness. And so that allows the mystery writer to sneak in clues because of the pervasive plant blindness in our society.
Yes. In fact, I was looking at a bookshelf full of gardening books in a bookstore. Was it just yesterday? It was the day before yesterday. I was in Missouri, so my head is still spinning. And there is a new book that I've added to my, you know, to-be-read list called In Defense of Plants. Mm. And, you know, it's kind of that same thing of people don't always notice them, right? They're all around them, you know, they're surrounded by this curtain of green. But it's just a backdrop as opposed to individual living things. And so that does, you know, the mystery writer has got to plant clues. And if you're going to do it well, you don't want the reader to be able to guess, at least not to guess easily. Because I know, at least as a reader, if I'm reading a piece of crime fiction or watching an adaptation on television, you know, or an original screenplay, if I guess it, I feel cheated. It's like, well, that's not the way it's supposed to work. I'm supposed to be surprised. And so, you know, plant blindness, which is something that all garden lovers try to combat, is something that really does help the crime writer.
Mm-hmm. I love your phrase of planting clues.
Yeah, and you know, it was fun for me to pick out these plant and garden elements and then track them down myself, you know, and find out more about them, because I certainly didn't know all about them when I I'd come across like caltrop. And it's a plant that occurs in the desert. And so Tony Hillerman used it in one of his novels. And then I learned that its common name comes from this ancient Roman weapon, which is sort of like, if you can imagine a kid's jack, you know, like jacks where you play jacks. But mm-hmm. all sharpened. It's, you know, it was this metal thing that they would cast out them, you know, in the hundreds in front of oncoming armies to damage feet of soldiers and animals, which is, you know, it's just kind of, it's horrible to think about.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's a seed with a very sharp spur that will stick into hiking boots and sneakers and things like that. So, you know, Tony Hillerman used it as something that stuck to the victim's clothing. Hmm. So, you know, as you say, it's like this, you know, plant forensics. And it really is still used. Someone at the Missouri Botanical Garden yesterday told me that, you know, their lab was featured on one of these 48 hours television shows for the part they played in apprehending a criminal from mm-hmm. from plant elements.
Yeah, I could see like pollen or seed release being integral to a plot as well in solving a mystery or a novel. So let's talk a little bit about the motive chapter. Gardening made me do it. And I was like, how could gardening be a motivation to any murder? And then I love that you talk about its motivation for many things, including perfectionism, and then also how competitive gardening is. And I never thought of gardening really as a competitive sport, but you're right, it can be.
Oh, yeah. And, it's not just flower shows, although, you know, that is, you know, the most visible and prominent competition among gardeners that you'll find and, you know, sanction. But it's also just, you know, who's got what. You know, I've gardened next to the same neighbor for 30 years. He has a glorious garden. And yes, along the border, there have been sort of very, you know, understated turf wars, no pun intended, but you know what I mean. Like, well, you know, who's going to plant on this space? I always say, you know, gardeners have this territorial imperative, right, where you want to take over more space. And, you know, gee, these trees are getting a little big. You know, he's got this Japanese umbrella pine, this Cyanopodes, that was this cute little thing when he planted it. And now it's, you know, it's really big and it's shading out my roses. And yet, you know, they're good neighbors. And so I don't complain. But once in a while, like, I'll snip his back surreptitiously. Don't tell him. And I'm sure he does the same on the other side. So I think we're quite even. His garden is always much tidier than mine.
Yeah, I would say the battle for sunlight, that could be motivation right there.
Yes. Yes, I totally agree. In fact, you know, that they had some storm damage where trees came down, and I really had to work at being sympathetic, you know. These trees. It's like, oh yeah, that's really too bad. But if you want to read a great, great short story about competitive gardening, I would say that there's a short story called Weeds by Ruth Rendell, or maybe it's Rendell. I'm sorry, I'm not sure of her pronunciation. That is kind of spine tingling.
I'm just going to read between the lines there of who those weeds could be.
Well, so the quote that I pulled out from that short story to head off that little section is, "The neatness of the gardens was almost oppressive."
Yeah.
And it was like a garden open day. And I don't, you know, if any of your listeners have ever hosted a garden tour, you know that it is, you know, it's super stressful. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one can imagine a murder happening. Sort of got tied up into that process.
Mm-hmm. So much effort goes into it, and then you hear some of the comments coming through.
Yes.
Maybe never be present for your open garden.
Yes, I was, and this was a public garden. I once worked in an iris garden. I only worked there for one season. And there, you know, for a garden that focuses on a single genera, it is a certain level of frustration because you work, you know, 11 months of the year to keep it just right. And then that the 12th month is total chaos because everybody wants to come see the irises around Memorial Day because it's glorious. And I remember, you know, working out there with, you know, then there's tremendous deadheading during that 1 month, and I'm deadheading and I hear someone go, "These are really pretty gladiolas." And I just wanted to go, "Okay, I quit." That's it.
Hopefully you didn't have like a scythe in your hand at that time.
That's so true.
That would have been justifiable homicide right there.
Yeah, someone asked me, was my husband worried when I was writing this book? And I said no. But then yesterday I was in a bookshop and I bought a dish towel that says, "Be nice to me or I'll poison your food."
Yeah, I would think you might be the number one suspect as the yes. author of the Gardening Can Be Murder book. So, Marta, you need to keep your nose clean and fly straight and right.
You bet. Don't leave my fingerprints around anywhere, at least.
So let's turn to, I think, what our listeners will be fascinated by the most is the deadly plant section and some of those favorite deadly plants of authors. And I would say monkshood is probably that top one because it is a scary, scary plant to me.
It is. And I'm always amazed. Every year, you know, in around September, I'll start to see them in bloom at the garden centers on display with no warning label, you know, like, don't plant this near your vegetable garden. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, if your partner does not know what a parsnip looks like, make sure that you don't plant this anywhere near where the parsnips are growing. Mm-hmm. Because it's super toxic. And, you know, how well. I mean, we do have lots of plants. I mean, there's one right behind me here in my workspace that is it's an indoor plant for this zone, but it's a Euphorbia terucali. It's a pencil plant. And, you know, this one, this variety has been selected for very colorful stems. And so it's called Sticks on Fire. And, you know, it's toxic, you know, I don't know. Among the euphorbias, some are more toxic than others. But they all, you know, have a sting if you get a lot of sap on you.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you worry about pets or small children around them, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, a friend of mine was cat sitting for her daughter, and the cat started eating her Diffenbachia and got really ill. So, you know, you just, have to be careful. But yes, they've been really popular in crime fiction. I think also because some of the great early crime writers like Agatha Christie and Dorothy L. Sayers, they had worked in pharmacies. And so they knew a lot about poisons. And so they got employed a lot for that, you know, not who done it, but how done it.
Interesting. Yeah. And I was shocked at the inclusion of rhubarb because, you know, obviously, we all have had rhubarb pie and eaten rhubarb, but that the foliage is so toxic.
Yes. So I think it would have to be in a very high concentration. So, you know, that was worked through in the plot. And it was interesting because I got to the author of that book because I had gotten in touch with Amy Stewart, who I know a little bit. And she, you know, in addition to writing so many wonderful books that are connected with plants, so she wrote Flower Confidential and Wicked Plants, and then she wrote a book called Wicked Bugs, and then she wrote a book called The Drunken Botanist. I mean, she's an absolute genius for coming up with great ideas. She turned her talents to writing crime fiction and wrote a series that, you know, her protagonist is a historical figure who was the first female, I think, deputy or sheriff in New Jersey. And so really interesting. She's written quite a few of them. And so I just took a shortcut and sent her an email and said, do any of your cop sisters' mysteries feature plants or gardening, thinking, well, you know, she knows a lot about plants, so she would be a natural. And she said, no, but you should contact Naomi Hirahara. And she's written some really interesting garden mysteries. So Naomi, one of her series, she's written a lot of different things. She's a journalist and a historian. But one of her mystery series, her protagonist is based on the life of her father, who was a first generation Japanese American, and as a adolescent was sent back to Japan for kind of a traditional education got stuck in Japan because of the Second World War, survived the bombing at Hiroshima, came back to America. And, you know, just as he's coming back to America as an adult, you know, can't get work like his, you know, his friends and family, because they're all coming out of the American internment camps. Mm. And so in Southern California, one job that Japanese Americans could get was being landscape gardeners. So that's what he did. That's what her brother did for a living. And so she bases the character of Mas Arai, her sleuth, on her father. And so the sleuth is a landscape gardener, and there are a lot of plant elements in it. So one of the books does feature rhubarb. I asked her if she ate rhubarb, and she said, no, I don't like it. I love rhubarb. I have a lot of it growing right in the middle of my flower garden because I think it's also a very ornamental plant. Mm-hmm. And I like a plant that, you know, not only is it ornamental, but I can eat it. So I really like it in the garden.
Excellent. Yeah, that's a series I'm definitely going to have to check out. And I noticed you also note in the book, aside from the many famous poisonous plants that do exist commonly in a lot of our gardens, that some mystery writers include fictional plants. And why do you think that is?
I think sometimes it is a way to get around fact checking.
That's what I thought you were going to say.
Right. So, yeah. You know, if you're not a botanist, then you can get kind of get lost in the technicalities of, you know, well, how much, you know, Nux vomica, aka strychnine, would someone have to ingest to blah, blah, blah. And so it just like eliminates that. Like for mm-hmm. me, I was worried about the chapter on, you know, pick your poison plant because I'm not a botanist. I'm not a scientist. Luckily, one of my cousins is a toxicologist. So you can imagine, dear Steve, would you mind reviewing my chapter? Because, you know, I just wanted to make sure I had the, you know, the verbiage correct and that mm-hmm. I wasn't out of line. And he did really help with corrections, even though he studies spider toxins rather than plant toxins.
Well, that could be a great mystery novel right there.
Yes, it could. Mm-hmm. Yes, it could.
Hmm. But a great resource to have in the family. And yeah, I was thinking also about, you don't talk too much about it because I think you're keeping it on the positive side, but there are some mystery novelists that totally miss the mark, right, on some of their plant use. Did you not include a few of those on purpose?
Well, I am very annoying to watch movies and you know, television programs with, because I'll go, those don't bloom together. That would never be blooming. Those are fake, mm-hmm. you know? mm-hmm. So it's kind of a burden. I think I only mention one of them when, I don't know, some author talked about a character falling into the thorny arms of the Pieris japonica. And it's like, no, that's not true. They don't have thorns. Nice try. So yes, I'm bad, you know, I proofread menus, you know, I'm a very annoying person.
Yeah, I always said that, you know, they have continuity editors on some TV and movie shows for the medicine and other things, but they really should have a gardening continuity editor for all books and film and media.
They absolutely should. You're right. We should promote ourselves, you know, as, you know, the garden consultants with some really major fees. I think you and I, Kathy, could like work on this.
Absolutely. I think a whole agency of us could be employed.
Yes, all around the country. So, you know, listeners, keep us in mind.
Well, I do want to say, Marta, that in Washington Gardener magazine, our October 2023 issue, we gave Gardening Can Be Murder an excellent review, and the reviewer was Beth Pye Lieberman. So our listeners can check that out as well. And I hope that you enjoyed that review if you've seen it yet.
I will look it up as soon as we are off this call.
I will send you a copy of that PDF so you can have that. And how can our listeners contact you?
So it is really easy to find me. My website is martamcdowell.com. I am on Instagram as @MartaMcDowell. So I'm not hiding. They can contact me through my website or, you know, through LinkedIn. But there's a contact me on my webpage. The book is available certainly directly from Timber Press. Both books are available on all of the usual online sites and your local indie bookstores. Please support your local indie bookstores. We love them. They are an endangered species, and, you know, we just really want to keep them going because they are wonderful parts of a community. We've lost our local bookstore, and if I hit the lottery, that's the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to bankroll someone to open a bookstore in my town.
Great thought. So thank you so much, Marta, for sharing about both your new books. And is there anything else you'd like our listeners to know about either book?
Well, I just think they're both fun in their own ways. And, you know, one is, you know, I guess I would say a more serious look at these five DuPont gardens for sure. It's, you know, what I wrote was all about their unique histories. And I had a blast writing Gardening for Can Be Murder. And I hope people have a good time reading it.
Thank you, Marta.
Thanks so much, Kathy.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Caryopteris plant profile. Blue mist shrub, Caryopteris species, also known as bluebird or blue spirea, is a small shrub that flowers from late summer to early fall for several weeks. It typically blooms in shades of blue. It is usually between 2 to 3 feet tall. Most Caryopteris are hardy from USDA Zone 9 down to Zone 5 and some to Zone 4. It blooms best in full sun and needs average garden soil that is not heavily enriched with fertilizer, or it can flop. Caryopteris is a low-maintenance plant. In the spring, cut it back to about 8 to 12 inches tall. It blooms on new wood, so the old part will not flower. Caryopteris is a deciduous shrub, and its flowers, leaves, and stems give off a faint, pleasant scent that make it deer-resistant. It is fairly heat and drought-tolerant as well. It has no major pest or diseases. Best of all, pollinators love it as much as you do. The tried and true cultivars are Dark Night with deep blue flowers and Longwood Blue, which has sky blue flowers. There are newer compact cultivars such as Petite Blue and First Choice. There are also forms with yellow or chartreuse foliage such as Sunshine Blue, Worcester Gold, and Almost Gold. Caryopteris, you can grow that. What's new in the garden this week? Well, I was gifted a pot of Hemibowie subcapitata glossy falsiningia, and it is doing wonderfully right now. It's blooming in full shade. The flowers are these big 2-inch tubular looking things. It's really quite stunning. The toad lilies are looking great, as well as the asters and the Nippon daisy, and I have the American witch hazel also in bloom in my home garden. Over at the community garden plot, I still haven't pulled the tomatoes and peppers and put in the garlic because it's been so mild and such great weather. I'm just still picking off of both of those, as well as zucchini. So maybe another week or so, and then I'll put in my garlic. Some local gardening events, if you're in the greater Washington, D.C. area, that you might want to attend include the UJAMA Cooperative Farming Alliance's Fall 2023 workshops, and they are taking place in Accokeek, Maryland on Friday, November 3rd and Saturday, November 4th. You can find out more information about that and register at ujamafarms.com. The Tacoma Horticultural Club is hosting their next meeting on Wednesday, November 15th from 7 to 9 p.m., and it is themed Your Gardening Questions Answered. Bring your gardening questions and submit them at the start of the meeting, and then a panel of garden experts will address them. It is free and open to all and takes place at the Tacoma Park Fire Station's community room at 7201 Carroll Avenue in downtown Tacoma Park, Maryland. And an online session you can attend from anywhere is the natureforward.org Conversation Cafe, and it is entitled Yes in My HOA Back and Front Yard, and that is nature writer and humane gardener founder Nancy Lawson, as she hosts a panel discussion among leading experts who've been on the front lines of advocating in Maryland and Virginia for allowing low-impact native habitat landscaping in HOAs and common interest communities. There is a registration fee of $10 to $15, and again, you can find out more about that at natureforward.org. Happy gardening!
Well, hey there, garden lovers. This is Ray Eaton, founder of Discover Garden Tours. I'm here to invite you all to join us next April and experience the beauty of Dutch gardening and horticulture on our Discover the Netherlands tour. Please join us and speaker, author, and social media influencer Kathy Gents for this once-in-a-lifetime garden adventure. We'll visit private and public gardens, flower shows and auctions, and much, much more. Highlights include the Kuchenhof Gardens, Hortus Botanicus Leiden, and the Flora Holland Flower Auction. The tour dates are from April 16th through April 25th, 2024. Full details and registration are available on our website at discoverourtours.com. Remember, space is limited, so if you don't want to miss out, I would highly recommend signing up today. We look forward to seeing you in the Netherlands and sharing this unforgettable journey together.
In the new book, The Urban Garden, by Kathy Gents and Terry Spade, you'll find dozens of inspiring and creative ways to grow flowers, shrubs, vegetables, herbs, and other plants in small spaces and with a limited budget. Whether you want to grow on a balcony, rooftop, front stoop, or a tiny urban patio, turn your growing dreams into reality and build a gorgeous and unique garden that showcases your personal style while still being functional and productive. With the ingenious ideas and resourceful tactics found here, you'll be maximizing yields and beauty from every square inch of your space while also making a lush outdoor living area you'll crave spending time in. Whether you're growing edible plants or beautiful flowers, the 101 amazing growing ideas found in the urban garden will Turn your tiny urban yard into a treasure trove of green you'll be proud to share with family and friends. Buy your copy today at your local retail bookseller or order it online now at Amazon.com or bookshop.org. Get low-maintenance alternative to lawns with the new book Ground Cover Revolution by Kathy Jentz. Reducing the lawn is among the biggest trends in homeownership, with an endless stream of homeowners looking for an eco-friendly alternative to a traditional, everyday grass lawn. In the last few years alone, over 23 million American adults converted part of the lawn to a natural landscape, and now are looking to do even more. The biggest challenge to adopting this new ideal, the perfect lawn, is knowing how and when to replace your turf and which plants are the best ones for the job. Ground Cover Revolution is here with all the answers you need. Included are 40 in-depth profiles of plants that are perfect choices for replacing a grass lawn. There are options for sun, for shade, for dry and wet sites, and for various climates around the globe. There are choices that bloom, options that are evergreen, and selections that are deer resistant. Author Kathy Jentz has also included an incredibly useful chart that gives you all the details on each of the 40 choices for quick reference and to make your ground cover selection process even easier. Whether you want to replace the entire lawn or just reduce the amount of land dedicated to turf, Ground Cover Revolution will help you usher in a new and improved idea of what a beautiful lawn should be. Available at bookstores now and also at Quarto.com, where you can get 30% off using discount code GARDENING30.
This is the last word on Fun with Pumpkins by Christy Page at the Food Gardening Network. It is officially fall. Oh, how I love this time of year. I love the crisp air, brisk mornings, and crunch of frost beneath my feet. The afternoons bring sunshine, a hint of warmth in the air, and the sounds of kids coming home from school. There's so much color everywhere. We still see the lingering green in the grass. Trees are alive with various jeweled tones before they drop their leaves for the winter. Along the ground, you can see patches of orange. It is pumpkin season. Pumpkins are such a versatile plant. How many other vegetables can you use for cooking, baking, snacking, and decorating? It seems like once the frost is on the ground, I start seeing pumpkins everywhere. They are popping up at farm stands, grocery stores, and even in some backyards. We have grown our own over the years, but love the selections that we can get at some of the larger farm stands. Growing up, my girls loved picking out their pumpkins each year. It was always an adventure and something that I had to set a lot of time aside for. I have a tendency to choose one fairly quickly. I like a small to medium-sized pumpkin that is pretty round, and I never mind a blemish or two. It just adds a little character. My daughters have very different tastes and ideas. My oldest daughter always wants a pumpkin that is perfectly symmetrical or as close as possible with a bright orange color. She already knows what she wants to carve and is looking for a shape that supports that. One year, she might be looking for something short and round, and the next, something taller and skinnier. My youngest daughter wants the biggest one she can find. She'll look at it, lift it, reject a lot of them before she finally decides. She may have an idea of what she wants to carve before choosing, but it almost always changes once she starts. One thing that we can all agree on is the process. We make sure that it is night where we don't have to rush out for anything else. We line the table with newspapers and get to work. We carefully scrape out the insides, making sure to save all the seeds. We rinse them carefully, put them on a cookie sheet with salt and just a touch of pepper, and let them start roasting while we work on our carving designs. Each year, we all try to do something different. We have had years where we tried shadowing, which really was not much of a success. We've done traditional freehand carving and even some more intricate work with stencils and stamps. The end results are always fun, but what is even more fun is the process. The house smells of fresh pumpkin and roasting seeds. There's a lot of laughter and joking about each other's designs, and there's a feeling of accomplishment when the jack-o'-lanterns are complete. After cleaning up, we put candles and our new jack-o'-lanterns, snack on fresh roasted pumpkin seeds, and admire our handiwork. We will keep them on display through Halloween before they get sent to the compost pile. It's hard to believe that a vegetable can give us so much enjoyment. Well, this was the last word on Fun with Pumpkins with Christy Page at foodgardening.com.
Thank you for listening to Garden DC. You can become a listener supporter for as little as 99 cents a month by going to anchor.fm/gardendc/support. Another way to support this podcast is to subscribe to our monthly digital publication, Washington Gardener Magazine. To do so, go to washingtongardener.com. Thank you. You can find Washington Gardener online at washingtongardener.com, on Twitter at WDCGardener, on Instagram at WDCGardener, and on Facebook.com at Washington Gardener Magazine.